I'd like you to turn to Leviticus 23, please. And I'd like to say I'm no authority on Leviticus 23, but whenever I have read it, it's really been a source of great joy to me. There's just so much in this chapter, far more than we can do justice to this morning, but let me just say, it was not only given to the Israelites to keep, but interwoven throughout, there's hidden here the plan of God's dealings right through the ages, right from the Exodus right through to the millennial glory of Christ. Some take it even further than that, but with my limited understanding, I see it in that way. Let's just read verse 38 for a moment. These offerings are in addition to those for the Lord's Sabbaths and in addition to your gifts and whatever you have vowed and all the free offerings you give to the Lord. So even though these look like a formidable array of feasts to us, they were to be kept in addition to what they were already offering. I wonder how that stats up with you and me. I wonder how we line up with the teaching of the New Testament, that we're bought with a price and we're to glorify God in our bodies, which are Christ's. Anyhow, more of that later. I want to look at it briefly under three headings. First of all, what did they mean for the people, for the Israelites? They had a direct meaning for the Israelites. And what is the prophetic teaching in these feasts? And what practical lessons can we draw from these feasts? Because I believe that when we read the scriptures, if we can't find some practical application, well, then we've lost something. God is speaking to us through these scriptures just as much as he was speaking to Moses, and just as much as he was speaking to the Israelites. Remember what Paul said in the New Testament to the Romans and Corinthians, I think. He said, whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for your learning. And he also said that these things happened unto them for examples, warnings. And so it's very important that we do not neglect the Old Testament. Now, coming to chapter 23 and verse 1, the Lord said to Moses, and I just draw your attention to that expression. It's there in verse 1. It's again in verse 9. The Lord said to Moses, and it's again in verse 23. The Lord said to Moses. I think this would naturally divide the chapter into three sections. But let's just look at the Sabbath for a moment, because it's listed as a feast of the Lord. Now, some of these were not really feasts at all. One at least was a fast, but it's still listed as a feast. So perhaps it would be better to call them solemn gatherings or sacred gatherings or sacred assemblies or something like that. However, they're normally referred to as feasts. Verse 1, the Lord said to Moses, speak to the Israelites and say to them, these are my appointed feasts, the appointed feasts of the Lord, which you are to proclaim as sacred assemblies. There are 6 days when you may work, but the 7th day is a Sabbath of rest, a day of sacred assembly. You are not to do any work. Wherever you live, it is a Sabbath to the Lord. Now, most of these, I suggest, could not have been kept until they reached Canaan, because they had to have access to the barley harvest. They had to have access to the wheat harvest and other things as well in order to carry out all the instructions that they were given. But perhaps they could have kept the Sabbath from the beginning. They could have put aside the Sabbath day as a holy day unto the Lord. I wonder, do we do that sort of thing in our lives today? So I think that as far as the Israelites were concerned, they would look upon this as necessary for not only their spiritual well-being, so that they could worship God, so that they could think upon Him and of all His goodness to them, but also as a physical thing. It's necessary for us to have a rest. And that's the perfect example that we have in Genesis chapter 2, is it? Where it says that God rested on the seventh day from all the work that He had done. And so that's the Sabbath. Now, the reason I pause there is that the Sabbath was to be kept weekly. Every week they were supposed to keep the Sabbath. Now, whether that meant that from the time they got into Canaan or from the time they left Egypt, I leave that to you to tell me. But as regards all the others, and there were seven others, they were to be kept annually. The first few were spring festivals to be kept around March, April. And the last few were autumn festivals to be kept around September, October in our calendar. Now, the calendar referred to here is a religious calendar. At the time that Moses wrote, no doubt there was at least one secular calendar in use, but here Moses used the religious calendar. And so when we come to verse 4, These are the Lord's appointed feasts, the sacred assemblies you are to proclaim at their appointed times. That seems like a repetition of what has already been stated in regard to the Sabbath. The Lord's Passover begins at twilight on the 14th day of the first month. And on the 15th day of that month, the Lord's Feast of Unleavened Bread begins, and so on. So here we have, and they're always coupled together, the Lord's Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, always coupled together. When we go over to the New Testament, sometimes the Passover is referred to and it includes both. Sometimes the Feast of Unleavened Bread is referred to and it refers to both. They were to be coupled together. And I think we'll see a reason for that later on, as time permits. So, if we go back to Exodus chapter 12, of course, we get all the detail of the Passover. And obviously, as far as the nation of Israel was concerned, they would remember by this feast that tremendous deliverance they had from the thraldom and the idolatry and everything else opposed to God that they were delivered from in Egypt. And so that would have been a wonderful time for them. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, what would they remember by that? Well, I understand it was the second day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which was to run for a week. A sheaf of the first fruits of the barley harvest was waved, and when it was waved before the Lord, that was an acknowledgement to the Lord of His great goodness to them. They were an agricultural people, and they depended so much on these products, and so their hearts would overflow with gratefulness as they saw a good harvest of barley or a good harvest of wheat or figs or whatever else they had in the land of Canaan. This Feast of Unleavened Bread perhaps would remind the women in particular of that hurried departure from Egypt when they had to carry the dough and the baking pans with them, when they were, as it were, pushed out of Egypt by the people and given all those things to take with them. So the Feast of Unleavened Bread perhaps would bring that to the remembrance of the Israelites. Then we have the Feast of First Fruits. And this is given prominence in the Old Testament, the first fruits. They would be looking for the harvest, and when the harvest was ready to cut, they would take a sheaf of the first fruits. They would give it to the priest, and that would be waved before the Lord, saying thank you to the Lord for his goodness in giving them the harvest. Only after they went through these formalities would they be allowed to go and harvest the crops. And this was done, this feast of first fruits was kept up the morrow after the Sabbath. How precious that is, as we'll see. It refers clearly to the resurrection of Christ. And we have authority for saying that from 1 Corinthians 15. Various offerings had to be offered, and this would have been a joyous occasion for them as they contemplated the goodness of God in giving them a harvest. There was, as I think I said, there were solemn aspects to these feasts, and there were joyous aspects to them. Solemn, when they had to offer a sin offering, as with the Passover and as on the Day of Atonement. But in many cases, they were joyous occasions. They were rejoicing before the Lord as they saw all his goodness before them. Then, following the next 7 weeks, 7 weeks rolled by, and this was locked into the time of the Passover, was the Feast of Weeks, or the Feast of Pentecost, as we more commonly call it. It occurred at a precise time relative to the Passover. And when we go to Acts chapter 2, of course, as we'll try and manage in a few moments, we'll see there that the day of Pentecost was fully come, and that was exactly that length of time after the Passover. The Passover is recognised by God. This Feast of Pentecost, as far as the Israelites were concerned, was also a harvest festival. And they would thank God for the beginning of the wheat harvest. Then two wave loaves are mentioned, and they were to be baked with leaven. If I'm not mistaken, this is the only offering that stipulated leaven. Leaven in the scriptures is a symbol of evil, or a symbol of sin. Some people say otherwise, but I believe in my heart of hearts that is the truth. And these wave loaves that were offered on the day of Pentecost, they were with leaven. And what the Israelites understood by that, I'm not certain, but the meaning for us is clear, as we'll come to a little later on. Then a long period of time went by, something like 3.5 to 4 months. It was indeterminate, although the Feast of Trumpets was to be on the first day of the seventh month. The Passover, the time of the Passover could vary somewhat for various reasons. And so this was a somewhat indeterminate period. The period from those spring feasts to the beginning of the autumn feasts, the Feast of Trumpets being the first. And I believe that has a meaning for us today as well. The Feast of Trumpets was to rally the people together, you might say, so that they might prepare themselves for the Day of Atonement, which came 10 days later. They had to examine their lives, and they had to confess their sins on the Day of Atonement. Then, as I've already intimated, 10 days after the Feast of Trumpets, or after the trumpets were blown, was the Day of Atonement. Now, that's made much of in the New Testament, and especially in Hebrews. The writer there is obviously thinking about the teaching of the Day of Atonement in the Pentateuch. Atonement was something given to God to make reconciliation possible to men. Isn't this reconciliation a wonderful truth to us today, that we can be reconciled to God? We who were afar off, we who were sinners of the Gentiles, can be made nigh by the blood of Christ. And I said that it was something given to God, and that something had to be blood. If we go into Leviticus chapter 16, where we get the Day of Atonement in great detail, we'll see there that blood had to be shed in order that Aaron might stand in the presence of God. If he went without blood on the Day of Atonement, he would die. And so it was. By this means he could enter the presence of God and not die. That's Leviticus 16 verse 2. Various sacrifices were offered on the Day of Atonement. In particular, there were two goats for a sin offering. One goat was the Lord's, and it satisfied the claims of a holy God. And the other goat was the sin offering on which the people's sins were put. And when that was done in a symbolic fashion, that goat was led off into the wilderness, as you will remember. And so all these are very precious truths for us. So coming down to the last one, the Feast of Tabernacles, that would remind the Israelites of God's blessings in their harvest and in all the work of their hands, and cause them to be filled with joy. That's a paraphrase of Deuteronomy 16 verse 15. Now, what of the prophetic view? When I was growing up, much was made of prophecy. In these days, we hear little of it. And when a suggestion is made, people tend to sneer and they say, "What's the authority for that?" Well, if you look at, and we'll do that right now, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, and verse 7, I will read verse 6 as well. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 verse 6. "Your boasting is not good," says Paul to the Corinthians. "Don't you know that a little yeast works through the whole batch of dough?" That means to say, if there's evil in the assembly, it's going to permeate the whole assembly. It's got to be stamped out. As verse 7 says, "Get rid of the old yeast, that you may be a new batch without yeast, without evil, as you really are." Positionally, that's what they were, but conditionally, they were far from that, as we learn from the early chapters of Corinthians. "For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed." Paul draws from Leviticus 23, and he says, as far as we are concerned, we don't remember the Passover as they remembered it, because we weren't delivered from Egypt. But Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. And we often sing that hymn, don't we? Is it 200 in believers? Which reminds us of what we have been delivered from. "We have known redemption, Lord, from bondage worse than theirs by far. Sin held us with a stronger cord, yet by thy mercy free we are." And Paul says, "Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Therefore keep the festival." That's not saying we should keep the festival of the Passover, as some would teach us today. It's simply saying, let us live in the light of the truths that we find in these scriptures. Not with the old yeast, not with sin, which in this case was the sin of malice and wickedness, but with the bread without yeast, the unleavened bread, the bread of sincerity and truth. But Paul is using a whole lot of metaphors here, and it's sometimes a little hard for us to work our way through them. But there's an authority for saying that we can we can look at this from a prophetic point of view, Leviticus 23 from a prophetic point of view, at least as far as Passover is concerned. And then one other verse I'd like to read at this point. It's in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And we have hints in these feasts of resurrection. And 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 20 says this: "But Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits." He's using an expression taken from Leviticus 23 and satiated passages. "Christ has indeed been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. For since death came through a man, the resurrection of the dead comes also through a man." And I'll read on. "For as in Adam all die, so in Christ all will be made alive, but each in his own turn. Christ the first fruits, then when he comes, those who belong to him." So these are, again, very precious truths for us. So let's just very quickly, in the space of a couple of minutes, just summarise the prophetic aspects of these feasts. The Sabbath would take us back to God's rest after creation, Genesis chapter 2. Passover, as we've already said, speaks vividly to us of Christ's sacrificial work at Calvary, 1 Corinthians 5. The Feast of Unleavened Bread reminds us that an encounter with Christ in his finished work demands that we walk in newness of life, that we live a holy life. And that's borne out again in 1 Corinthians 5 and also in Romans 6 and 1 Peter chapter 1, where Peter quotes that verse, "Be ye holy, for I am holy." That's, he's talking about living lives with practical holiness. The Feast of First Fruits speaks of the resurrection of Christ. We've already read that in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 20. "And when the Lord comes for his own, those who sleep in Jesus will be raised from among the dead," just as the Lord Jesus was raised from among the dead. All the dead didn't rise, did they? But he rose from among the dead. So when he comes in glory, we will be raised from among the dead. But Christ the first fruits, afterwards those that are Christ that is coming. The Feast of Weeks or Pentecost speaks of the descent of the Holy Spirit on the day of Pentecost. And that was in AD, about AD 32. The two wave loaves speak of Jew and Gentile, amalgamated in the newborn church. And we should just read Ephesians chapter 2 to support that. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 14. "For he himself is our peace, who has made the two one." I take it that means Jew and Gentile. "And has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility, by abolishing in his flesh the law with its commandments and regulations. His purpose was to create in himself one new man out of the two, thus making peace." Of course, that's the church. The church was inaugurated on the day of Pentecost, and officially, at least, it would consist of Jew and Gentile, although on that day perhaps there were no Gentiles. There may have been proselytes, but there were no Gentiles as such. So that's a wonderful teaching concerning the two wave loaves. And then the long period from Pentecost to trumpets, to my mind, would clearly speak of this present church age. We don't know when it's going to end. It's only the Father who knows when it's going to end. And so just as that period was an indeterminate period, so this period that we're in now is indeterminate in nature. Now, just a note on the trumpets, if I can just say in one space of 1 minute something about the trumpets. People
that get wrong ideas about the trumpets, get wrong ideas about prophecy. And then they finish up saying there's no rapture, or if there is a rapture, it's at the end of the tribulation, at the last trump, as they say. But there's a trumpet call for the church. That's 1 Corinthians 15, or 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. And there are trumpet calls as depicted in the Feast of Trumpets. Perhaps two silver trumpets. They were two silver trumpets in Numbers chapter 10. They'll be sounded after the church is gone. And any others who are raised at the rapture, after they've gone. And then the trumpets will sound just like the what we have prophetically in Leviticus 23, the Feast of Trumpets. They'll sound and they'll be calling Jews from all around the world to come home to their own land. And that's also intimated in Matthew chapter 24, verse 31 by the Lord. The seven trumpets of Revelation, that was written 50 years after this, after Pentecost. The seven trumpets sounded successively by the seven angels announced specific judgments that will take place during the tribulation, a time of unparalleled destruction occurring prophetically between the Feast of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement, which will occur just prior to the Feast of Tabernacles, prophetically speaking. The Feast of Trumpets depicts Israel's gathering in the land from all around the world. The Day of Atonement will be fulfilled when they will look on him. And if I quote from Zechariah chapter 12, it says, "They will look on me, the one they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only child." They will have experienced the terrible throes of the tribulation. And then, as the Lord comes in power and great glory, they will see the one that was rejected at Calvary. Their fathers, their forefathers had rejected them, rejected him, and they said, "His blood be on us and on our children." And now they will look on him whom they pierced, and they will mourn. There will be deep contrition, deep mourning, as they own their Messiah. The Feast of the Tabernacles will then have its fulfillment. We will be with the Lord, presiding over the earth. We're going to reign with him, and Israel will be enjoying their final rest under the millennial reign of Christ. Now, just a few practical lessons. Over and over again, in those Old Testament passages, we read words like these: "This is to be a lasting ordinance for you." Leviticus 16:34. God was impressing on them that these were very important and they must be observed. Sadly, the people didn't observe them. I was talking to somebody the other day and I was saying, you know, from the days of Joshua right through to Nehemiah, the Feast of Tabernacles was never kept. And that's in Nehemiah 8 and 17, I think. But they were required to be kept. I wonder how we respond to the commandments that we are given to keep in the New Testament. Are we any better than those people of old who so often neglected the commandments of the Lord? And the Apostle Paul writes, "Let us not give up meeting." Remember, these feasts were holy convocations. They were sacred assemblies. And we in church life, we have sacred assemblies, don't we? And Paul or whoever wrote Hebrews says, "Let us not give up meeting together, as some are in the habit of doing, but let us encourage one another." The two wave loaves we've mentioned were baked with leaven, which on face value seems to be very strange, but it reminds us that we still have an old sinful nature. we have met, and youth too, perhaps have met people who say they've reached the stage of sinless perfection. In one part of the world, these people are called perfectionists. But we could mention some that we met in Papua New Guinea, and some of the things that happened to them were far from perfection. So we still have the old nature. That must be kept in the place of death, Romans chapter 6. And the grace of God teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions, and to live self-controlled, upright and godly lives. Titus chapter 2. The Feast of First Fruits, the resurrection, surely would remind us that we are to set our hearts on things above, set our minds on things above, not on earthly things. And in Matthew chapter 6, the Lord said, store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Today, in this world that we seem to be locked into, we're storing up treasures on earth, aren't we? But the Lord Jesus said, store up for yourselves treasures in heaven. The Day of Atonement would remind us to be conscious of sin in our lives and keep short accounts with the Lord. Paul said to the Corinthians, a man ought to examine himself. That means scrutinize himself. Not just a casual remembrance of the past week. Oh yes, it hasn't been too bad. But a man ought to scrutinize himself before he eats of the bread and drinks of the cup, 1 Corinthians 11. The Feast of Tabernacles would remind us that there remains then a Sabbath for the people of God. Isn't that a precious thought? A blessed prospect. There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Hebrews chapter 4 verse 9. We were trying to help a brother many years ago who was dying of cancer. 2 weeks or 2 months after that, he passed into the presence of the Lord. And I just happened to play a hymn to him, and he was following the words. And those words were very precious to him. It's Believer's Hymn Book number 22. And the last verse I'd like to read to you, words written by a Hannah Burlingham, 1842 to 1901. And these are some of the words she wrote. Come, Lord, come, we wait for thee. We listen still for thy returning. Are we listening for that trump of God? Thy loveliness we long to see. For thee the lamp of hope is burning. Come, Lord, come. And so may the Lord bless our very brief excursion through Leviticus 23. May it stimulate us to look further into such scriptures as these, because they are real gold mines, spiritually speaking. So may God bless you.